Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And as a matter of fact, today, because we've been covering over the past few days when I don't have Tammy with me, and so unfortunately Tammy's not here today. And so on the, I think Thursday, last week, Friday, we started covering some topics. And one of the topics, just due to the fact that Trump is actually going out and replacing many of the attorneys, state, federal attorney generals assigned to the states in different areas or parts of the states. And so I want you to think about that. I want you to look at the Department of Justice and look at how many lawyers are hired and how, you know, they have them in every state. So because he's revamping, we are actually getting some patriots into the attorney general seats. We want to start leveraging. I think on this last Monday, I said we need to start shaking the tree of the Department of Justice. We need to start shaking the tree of the White House and Trump's administration. The problem is that nobody really understands. Now, it came up in President Trump's last administration as he was getting ready to retire, because he was voted out, not legitimately, but nevertheless, there was discussion about using Section 3 of the 14th Amendment against him. Now, we talked a bit about that, but we need to dive into Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, but we can't do that without really talking about the 14th Amendment. Now, what we're going to do when I'm finally done with this tirade, maybe today or tomorrow, we're going to finally get into the act to regulate deposits of the public money. This was done by Andrew Jackson, and he did. This was another one of the things he did. He had no constitutional authority to do, and he basically, this is where he started really changing our paradigm regarding currency and as far as the printing of money and so forth. So we'll get into this and we'll show you how this act that he had, he kind of drove this, how he literally changed and shifted. Most people, they laud him for getting us out of debt, but he didn't do that. We proved that he never did that. The plan was done by Madison, who created the second bank. Now, he may not have created and didn't renew the bank, but he did something worse. He actually created a bank without calling it a bank. Because what he started doing is he started throwing money throughout the Republic. They didn't have the authority to do that. They didn't have the authority to give states, you know, a little deposits or chunks of money. We'll get into this when we get to the content, because it's all in here. And again, this is the first time I've read this, because all of this, you know, every year I'm learning as we discover more and more things that highlight the government's overreach and how unconstitutional, how we got into this mess. A lot of people, and wrongfully so, I assumed that the Organic Act of 1871 was the real problem, and it wasn't. We've actually discovered it was the Enabling Act of 1816 of Indiana. Indiana was brought into the Union unconstitutionally. In other words, there were restrictions placed, unconstitutional restrictions placed on them from the federal government. So this is why we expose all of these things. We expose the diabolical plan regarding the Federalist Papers. I'm working on a presentation, or actually working on an article so that everybody can start sharing this. We need to start attacking those Federalist Papers, and we need to actually attack anybody that uses them. It's one thing to, you know, gain a little insight, but to cite them as a source document of defining the Constitution is repugnant to the Constitution itself. And this document is actually going to get into it, because when you actually look at the intent behind the Federalist Papers were really, the intent of Hamilton and Madison was to help New York ratify the Constitution. It was just basically creating editorials in a newspaper. But those editorials weren't factual. In other words, they weren't legally created. They weren't under testimony, and it wasn't done, you know, because the people had selected them to do this. This was just ambitious Hamilton trying to actually create basically propaganda. Now, I don't think at the very beginning he was being propaganda-ish. He understood how the Constitution was sold, and he, for the most part, he stuck to it until the end. He actually started playing around with theory and those types of things throughout the Federalist Papers, because when he started doing that is when he started concocting the scheme that what he will do is he'll augment the Federalist Papers at the very end, so he can tuck, and he saved, made sure they did not discuss the judiciary. And he basically created the Federalist Papers on the judiciary after the Constitution was ratified. What does that mean? That means that those documents of the Federalist Papers really weren't out there into the public's eyes or public stream. And what he literally did in those articles was he injected unconstitutional theories and principles for the judiciary to use and function in America, clearly unconstitutional. There is nothing in the Constitution that allows the Supreme Court and the federal court system to use case law and precedents. They didn't declare common law. They created a system that would be able to interface on a case-by-case basis with every state, because every state had its own unique legal difference. And so that was their requirement, which is why they had the responsibility of hearing and judging cases based on law and fact. They had very limited jurisdiction. They weren't active. They couldn't go and actually pursue, pull in a case because it's interesting to them. These cases had to come to them on appeal. And when you look at Marbury v. Madison, that was a case that never was actually appealed. Marshall just reached over and said, I'm going to grab this. Because he was combating, Marshall was deliberately combating Thomas Jefferson, and Thomas Jefferson trying to reduce the lawyers throughout the United States. Now see, I'm bringing this up because what did I start the show off with? Well, Trump is actually replacing these lawyers with patriots. I know two, and I'm hoping Darren Smith got actually confirmed, and I believe, because I've talked to the Washington State Anyway, you know I'm bad with names. So anyway, I've actually talked to him. I've talked to Darren. So these guys at least know that I'm not a turnip that fell off the truck when it comes to the Constitution. Therefore, what we want to do, and the intent behind all of this, is to get the Justice Department to actually create the process of holding people accountable to their oath. And that's why this last Monday, I read that letter to Bob Ferguson and how basically Attorney General Bondi was basically saying, you know, if you don't play, you know, play with us, or if you don't play fairly, if you don't do what we expect you to do, we may bring criminal charges. And the rhetoric between Bob Ferguson's office now coming out and supposedly lambasting the Attorney General Bondi's office and Trump, it's all hyperbole. And I don't understand why we're playing this kiddie game. And as a matter of fact, oh, look at the lawyers, you know, squaring off and drawing their sabers or swords and fighting it out. Why? The supreme law of the land demands that any person that refuses to comply to the Constitution, and to be clear, the Constitution does not let you split the baby on this. You must repel the invaders. State, local, federal, everybody has to work in supporting that Constitution and getting invaders out of America. Now, Congress, for years and years, started relabeling them as immigrants. Technically, Congress has no authority over immigrants at all. None. They've assumed that. They assumed that because of, for security purposes, whatever. It's not constitutional. They never amended the Constitution to do it. But the states let them go along and started creating this INS system and so forth. Okay, so this is the problem we've got to fix. And we can fix this down the road. But bottom line, right now, the states have allowed the federal government to manage immigration, and Trump needs to get it in his head, right there between his eyebrows, he needs to get it into his head that calling these people immigrants is absolutely constitutionally inaccurate. An immigrant is a person who actually is pursuing to live here and become a citizen. And the process to do that is done before you come to the port of entry. You actually apply and you say, I want to become a citizen. And there's people around the world, all sorts of people that have registered with the State Department and have requested that they actually come into the United States so that they can become a citizen. Why? Because the embassy system, which falls under the State Department, actually kind of manages that. People will go into the U.S. Embassy in any nation, and they'll walk in and say, I'd like to have an application to become a citizen. And they happily hand it to them. And then they get processed. And once you have approval, once you get the approval that you can come in as an immigrant, then you show up. But if you come up and just want to cross that line, and you make no effort prior to you coming to engage as an immigrant, you are an invader, and you're playing somebody's political game to undermine our system. Whose game is this? This has been the progressive communists who have been operating and running an insurgency against our Constitution from within the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And I'm saying Republican Party because there are many Democrats that are Republicans. We call them rhinos. The problem with the parties, the Republicans especially, is that they're conservative, they're not constitutional. We've also gone down that path. So today, I believe the important focus is to really demysticize, to basically kill these myths in regards to the 14th Amendment. We talk about this, we go through this every year when we go through the Constitution. But in tandem and in direct association with what Attorney General Bondi is doing and President Trump is doing, they, because President Trump has already come out and kind of attacked this concept of an anchor baby. They already did that in an EO. The real problem is that the language in his EO, and I said this then, and I'm going to say it again, he's got lawyers writing this crap, and they are all working within a paradigm that the courts have the ability to change laws, make laws, redefine things. And he, President Trump needs to understand this. Please go read Article 3. The federal courts do not have jurisdiction or any delegated authority to interpret the law, to redefine the law, to use case law and precedents to move a law and principles forward, to actually, you know, get involved in legislating and creating law is treason. The only entity that has legislative power is Congress. This is what Section 1 says. All legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. No power mentioned for the judiciary or the executive. The executive has negative powers. He can veto, but he can't say, you know, yeah, we're changing this law to do this. This is what we want to do. We're creating new law. They can't do that. He can't create currency. He can't do anything. He has to get the laws and everything to be done as long as it's in pursuance to the Constitution. In other words, as long as it's a direct derivative of those enumerated objects in Article 1, Section 8. If it's those, like, you know, needful buildings, forts, magazines, arsenals, they can't. The BLM possessing land, farmland, any land like that, that is not within the Constitution. And so Trump could actually say, you know, we're going to wipe our slate clean. We got to get rid of this. Right now they're trying to sell it, where they're trying to make money off of it. Their job is to never make money. Their job is to function at a deficit over those very specific objects that we've delegated to them. And if they actually did that, folks, our budget would go down well under a trillion easily. Easily, especially if we streamlined everything the way it should be. It's like the Department of Defense. The Department of Defense is fat and bloated. There's way too many officers and there's way too many people in service right now. We're not at war. The only entity that should be functioning worldwide and maintaining and managing our strategic defenses is the Navy. Because they actually have the responsibility of creating and operating and maintaining that Navy. The Army, and you know, if you want to call the Army and their Air Corps, the militia, is because they don't even have the authority to have an Air Corps, so it would be a part of the Army. So the Army actually has the authority to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. That's it. They do not have, the federal government cannot take, you know, your young men and women and deploy them around the world. They can't do it. But they're doing it because 1903, they passed the Dick Act, and they said, we're going to completely revamp this, and we're not going to amend the Constitution, and you're going to let us do it because we're going to give you money. Folks, they're getting away with murder, and we have to stop this. So we need to demysticize, and we need to basically take the myths out of the 14th Amendment. So let me get back to the 14th Amendment. The reason this is critical is because I never understood why people would call the 14th Amendment the worst amendment. It was the boogeyman, the evil things, because the 14th Amendment never did anything bad. The 14th Amendment was redefined by the courts constantly. Many parts of the 14th Amendment have either been completely obviated or they have been completely redefined, like equal protection under the law. Equal protection of the law does not mean separate but equal. Well, but the court said it did. And that's why the Jim Crow laws were unconstitutional, because the courts allowed them to do that. Folks, you know, I laugh when I hear, I'm talking to patriots, and, you know, I can recall this one time. I was on, I think it was the Patriot Soapbox. There was some gentlemen that were, you know, speaking on that. I don't know if they were hosts or what have you. But they were bragging about their 30 years of study. And they were citing all these legal cases and so forth. And how certain, you know, laws were redefined and so forth. And they did this and they did this. In other words, they were accepting this unconstitutional behavior of the court. And they were laying everything out to basically say, see, the 14th Amendment did those things. It opened the door so they could do those things. No. No, the 14th Amendment was clearly denned. It was confined. It was constricted and basically tied down to do very specific things. The very first line in Section 1 identifies that now, today, after the 14th Amendment had been ratified in 1868, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, or subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. In other words, they're actually under the jurisdiction at this point in time, but they are not citizens. They may have been naturalized, Or they may not be, but they've been born, and their entire life they've been under the jurisdiction of the United States. Born under somebody else that was under the jurisdiction of the United States. Which means, who would that be? That would be the generations of slaves and the Indians who have now been moved around and controlled by this claiming of federal land. They have actually, within the treaties, or not treaties, within the territories, which is federal land, as they've moved them out, prior to them even creating reservations, prior to even that unconstitutionally being done, as Jackson moved the Cherokee on the Trail of Tears and killed many of them, and moved them out, I think, went to Oklahoma. You know, and then Oklahoma has become this bastion for Indians, and actually, no, they're citizens. Now, it's one thing to have, you know, your cultures and those types of things, but they're all citizens of the United States. They don't necessarily have to, you know, you don't have to participate in voting if you don't want to. But as the United States came to be, and as the Indian nations existed at that point in time, there was a huge abyss between these cultures. And actually, under the laws of nations, Britain and Portuguese and Spain and all these European nations, France, were coming and discovering and colonizing. They were colonizing. And so as they colonized, they basically followed, supposedly they were supposed to follow the laws of nations. And the laws of nations basically said how you're to tend for the indigenous people, you know, by incorporating them, but you've got to be humane and civil. And you got to keep everything down. You know, you try not to allow wars and the shedding of life. But look at how brutal the Portuguese and the Spanish were. They stole all of their wealth and sent it back to their country, and some of it, you know, is at the bottom of the ocean because the ships crashed or what have you. But nevertheless, they stole their entire wealth out of those land masses. And what they did was they actually started raping the women so that they created a whole new class of people to subdue them. That didn't happen in the Americas, did it? No, it didn't. England, if you really look at England, because that was the monarchy, that was the empire that was managing all of the rest of the world, right? Other than these little, especially when they, in the 1600s, when they knocked out the Spanish Armada, right? I mean, actually, it was the late 1500s. Nevertheless, when they knocked out the Spanish Armada, they became the empire of the world. They became the big dog. And they became the bigger dog as time went on. Bottom line, they all were functioning under the laws of nations, and they created a system. And when we revolted, we basically took the system that we had. We created a whole new constitution, but we had to recognize the laws of nations so that we could continue to engage in commerce and what have you, because these were the accepted ways of trade and laws and so forth. The laws of nations even defined citizenship, which is why the Constitution, in citing the laws of nations, the framers in citing it, basically included the natural-born citizen to ensure America could not be overcome by the intrigue and the interest of European powers. They would have to actually, they'd have to migrate here, and they would have to become a citizen. They couldn't just walk in and become the president. So that the whole design was to try to protect America from actually being taken back over by Britain or any European nation. So this first line clearly dives into, we're going into break. This first line is strictly the citizenship and converting all Indians and blacks or the slaves in America to citizens. Why did they do this? Because Supreme Court Justice Taney unconstitutionally said they couldn't be citizens. We'll talk more about this when we come back. Let's go into the break. I'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so Taney basically made the assertion that no black person could be a citizen. Now, there's nothing in the Constitution that dictates the race of a person and that only white people could be citizens. This racism became this byproduct of slavery and the fact that there were freedmen in America. This is one of the reasons why we exposed to you Thomas Jefferson's plan to repatriate the freemen in America so that they could get out of this racial, you know, environment and start over. Now, there was no authority in the Constitution to do that. And I've already come out and said that it may have been a noble thing and it was a single one-time violation, or, you know, the effort was, you know, this one-time push of helping establish a foothold for freemen of America to go. So America, or the United States government under Monroe, actualized Jefferson's plan by buying on the far west side or the west coast of Africa this nation called Liberia, and started repatriating freemen from America to there. Oh, okay, so why and what happened? Well, they actually started sending them, and unfortunately, because they were going into a new, you know, germ, they didn't have the immune systems, some of them died. Just like when the you know, settlers came to America, white settlers and so forth, they died because of the, you know, the mosquitoes, those, not just because they were interacting with natives, and actually there was very little interaction. In other words, there may have been interaction by Portugal and Spain, but with Britain, there wasn't a lot of interaction. There wasn't this, you know, raping and pillaging. That wasn't happening. As a matter of fact, I think the first instance of hostility was in Roanoke. The settlers for Roanoke all disappeared. I mean, who knows? There were no bones. There was nothing left of the, you know, I think there was like 50, 60 people that were there. They were left there. They came back after the winter. They were all gone. What happened? They had the, you know, kind of like this little village that they kind of created. It wasn't like out of concrete or nothing, but they go, huh, well, this is where they were. What happened to them? That has never been disclosed. But in Jamestown, they actually said, okay, the next settlement we'll do in Jamestown, go up the river and establish. And what they did was they created, you know, walls and so forth to kind of build a fort just in case it was the indigenous people. They didn't know. And so they, you know, built a fort, and the first winter, the indigenous people raided them, tried to steal stuff, you know, and vandalize and that type of thing, harass them. Because, you know, these white people were actually sheltered. They had their stores and so forth. So they were prepared for the winter, and the indigenous weren't so prepared or what have you. So they tried to steal their stores, goods, what have you. Anyway, if you kind of look at it, that was really the first documented hostility. But there had always been this attempt and effort to try to make trades and agreements and so forth. This is why, you know, with the, you know, the Puritan Thanksgiving, we can see that, you know, wasn't warring initially. And I think we even got the story of the wampums for Manhattan. And the Indians laughed, and, you know, they got these wampums for nothing because nobody can own the land. Their paradigm was, you know, you can't own land. Ah. See, the Bible actually establishes property rights, right? Because in the commandments, thou shalt not steal, which means that when somebody makes a claim for something, this is mine, and or they pay for it, or however they get to say, this is mine, that becomes theirs. And so the concept of property goes all the way back to that far. Now, the Roman Empire made the several property understanding and definition for them, but that's not the same. And as a matter of fact, most academics will say, oh, well, it was the Romans that actually created the law of property. No. God did. Thou shalt not steal. That means that you're taking somebody else's property. So anyway, as we're looking at the 14th Amendment, this very first line was all about the citizenship. The second line was all about the problems, the evil that the states were doing, and acknowledging that the states had and are still being and will probably always be the bad actors. So this is why they basically said, no state shall make or enforce any law, this is the second line, any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. What that means is that a state cannot make a law and or enforce a law that would take away your fundamental rights that are protected by the Constitution or recognized by the Constitution, which means your parental rights, which means your rights to commerce, which means your right to petition government, which means your right to go to church, which means your right of habeas corpus, or the writ of habeas corpus. Folks, states have been actually creating laws violating this part, still to this day. As a matter of fact, the pandemic, every state that tried to use, there's no exception here. There's no little parentheses that says, except an emergency. Why? Because they were killing people, and they would use an emergency to do so in the future. They knew this. They said, no, you're done. You cannot make or enforce any law moving forward that you know, basically basically abridges the privileges or immunities, takes away, diminishes your privileges and immunities guaranteed by this Constitution. The next line is the next line is equal protection and due process. Nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without the process of law, which is due process of law, nor deny any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. In other words, if you're open to the public, you're a restaurant, and you basically allow people to come in there and sit, then you cannot make differentiations of where people sit. If you basically put all the people in the back of the bus that are black, then and they use the separate but equal, because that's the Jim Crow laws, then you're depriving them of and denying them their equal protection. They have equal right and access to everything everybody else would have. And we're all to be protected. Same thing, it doesn't matter what your race is, it doesn't matter with your gender or those types of things. And I'll even say it, it doesn't matter what your sexual orientation is, as long as these things that you're pursuing are, you know, legitimate, openly public things. In other words, like access to the restaurant or seating at the restaurant, seating at the theater, seating on the bus, access to the same menus. You cannot disparage and or deny people, you know, by creating a law that basically says they get second class or they don't get the same thing. That right there is not equal protection under the law. But the courts redefined that. The courts basically said, yeah, you can segregate. They legalized segregation when clearly segregation would be a violation of equal protection under the law. Because now you're splitting the law to say, you know, these people can have this and these people have that. Anyway, the next line or the next section is the section on apportionment. Section 2 basically dives into, and I'm not going to read it, because we'll get into this on the when we get into the 14th Amendment. So there's no boogeyman in Section 1. It doesn't do anything bad. The courts have done all the bad crap out of this. The courts created the anchor baby interpretation. This was never interpreted that a foreigner could come here and assume as soon as they're here, they get jurisdiction. The immigration process and the uniform rule for naturalization created by the federal government didn't allow that. Well, the court said, well, we're going to undo that. The laws of nations didn't even allow that. And so we're the only nation where the courts have screwed us up and said, no, you make it here, you become a citizen. You get all rights. No. As a matter of fact, even right there with the no state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States. If you're not a citizen of the United States, if you're an invader, or maybe a state's national, you're not entitled to due process, equal protection under the law. You're not entitled to those things, folks. And the court has basically redefined all of that. So the second section is all about apportionment, and it basically goes after the states that if they deny voting access to blacks or Indians, any person that now is a citizen, because it basically says here, citizens of the United States. So in other words, if they're 21 years of age and they're citizens of the United States, then they cannot deny these people the access to voting. If they do, then the state will actually be punished by a direct reduction, one for one, in their apportionment. So in other words, if they say we're not allowing blacks to vote, and you have, you know, one-third of your population are black, then one-third of your apportionment goes away. In other words, let's say you had 30 representatives, one-third, now you only have 20. In other words, what they wanted to do was they wanted to punish the states. They didn't necessarily want to get into the knickers of making an amendment to say you have to let them vote. They basically says, because we look at taxation and representation equally, as well as voting, therefore, if you actually deny the voting, we're going to deny you the using those people that you're denying access of apportionment. In other words, you're going to lose your apportionment. Section 3. Before I get to Section 3, let me get to Section 4. Section 4, so there's no boogeyman in Section 2. It basically holds the states accountable for if they play shenanigans. And to me, the consistency is that they wanted to make sure citizens of the United States had the right to vote. And when we go through all of the four amendments regarding granting voting rights, all four amendments clearly say no person of whatever gender or sex, whatever race or whatever age, as long as you're 18 years of old or older, no person shall be denied, no U.S. citizen shall be denied the right to vote. Because it's very specific. No U.S. citizen, states national, yes, you can deny them. Immigrants, yes, you can deny them. You have to get U.S. citizen status, period. So Section 4 is the really big black eye where the federal government or Congress at the time created a law that basically says the validity of the public debt of the United States authorized by law, including debts incurred for payment of pensions and bounties for services in suppressing insurrection or rebellion, shall not be questioned. In other words, paying off the debt of the North, the Union, that debt and the payment off of that debt will not be questioned. But neither the United States nor any state, if you're in the Union, nor any state, what happened? Okay, there we go. Nor any state shall assume or assume to pay any debt or obligation incurred in aid of the insurrection or rebellion against the United States, or any claim for the loss of emancipation of a slave, but all such debts, obligations, and claims shall be held illegal and void. So the South, you know, first off, they couldn't come back and say, you owe us property rights, because you stole our property, you owe us money for taking our property away from us. That stopped that. But bottom line is, there's no such thing as reparations in the Constitution. We've got something wrong, we get it right, we move forward. We get it right, and we move forward. There's no such thing as justice, or I should say, financial reward, civil law. When we look at the legal system of civil law is basically to extract a punishment upon a party that may have done something wrong. Common law doesn't do that. Common law restores what was taken, but there's no punishment. And so you think twice before doing that again. No. Common law actually just seeks to, you know, get everything restored so the justice and people can move forward. So when we look at Section 4 was literally a poke at Europe and those European nations, and especially Britain, because Britain was heavily vested in trying to undermine the United States by supporting the South in the Civil War. Heavily. So heavily that when Britain saw the 14th Amendment come out, and it was going out to be ratified, and in the 1866 election, it actually got ratified by 1868. In other words, the people in the states actually ratified it, and if you go through the process, they all ratified it. There were three states. And by the way, they didn't need, because the southern states seceded. They didn't say anywhere here where you can't secede. As a matter of fact, they knew that the southern states seceded, which is why they didn't allow these southern states to just come right back in, to just show up. No, no, no. You actually left. You created a new government. You want to come back, you have to petition, and we will have to, according to the Constitution, admit you as a new state. You don't go all the way back to zero. Your birthday starts all over again when you come back in. That's your new birthday. So bottom line, when we, you know, look at this process of the 14th Amendment and the secession, well, those states, when you, because we've got it in a spreadsheet, there was plenty of votes in the ratification by the northern states. There was no need to ratify based on the southern states' votes. And and this is why you see these people who argue against the 14th Amendment that, oh, they didn't leave. They couldn't left. No, they did, and they were out. Those, when they actually can reconvene Congress to vote for the 13th Amendment, that link, you know, the emancipation. Well, when that happened, guess who didn't show up? Those states didn't show up because they actually did leave. So you can't have your bread buttered on both sides. Lincoln was wrong. States can secede. We've already covered this several times. Madison even proves it. It's in the ratification debates. It's all over the place. You, when you feel that you are, you know, the contract's being violated, any party to the compact can basically, if they recognize that this is both willful and material, they have the right to step out, nullify the laws, and no longer be a part of the union. In so doing, they had to come back. And the requirement of ratifying it was only done to say, hey, you can't not acknowledge when you come into the union, you have to acknowledge that all of this you have to abide by. Because, you know, the South was notorious for playing the juvenile games of hiding their hand behind their back with their fingers crossed. That kind of crap. And so, unfortunately, they literally had to, you know, account for, or at least be prepared to say, sorry, we're not playing that game with you. And this is what you're going to get, and this is what's happening. So as we look at the 14th Amendment, Section 3, it is all about everybody but the president. That's why it says no person shall be. In other words, it's saying that you cannot be in public office at these levels. It says senator, representative of Congress, elector. Interesting, they actually include the elector of the president and vice president. That's actually a person that's supposed to exist. We're supposed to be voting for electors, and they exist for 4 years. It's just a function that the party does now. And that's how the party has basically stolen unconstitutionally access to our public offices. Anyway, or hold any office, civil or military. You can't even be in the military. You cannot be in the military or any public office under the United States or under any state who, having previously taken an oath. Now, remember that every employee of the United States had to take an oath. That was a part of the very first act. You worked for the GAO, you had to take an oath. And I believe that was the standard back then. Nowadays, we're only going to limit it to those, those people. We're not going to have the school teachers who are receiving your tax dollars swear to support the Constitution, because we actually want them to attack the Constitution and basically teach children to basically revolt against the Constitution. And therefore, if they have to take an oath, then you might be able to hold them accountable, especially because of Section 3. Folks, if you're the librarian, if you're a person that is making a living, you're receiving income or any type of an emolument off of tax dollars, the money coming into you is from the taxpayers, you need to take an oath. Every citizen is legally obligated by the oath of a citizen in the requirement to take up arms to support and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against enemies, foreign and domestic. So, as we go through this, then it even includes the judicial officers. But basically what it says, who having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or a member of the state legislature, executive or judicial or any state, basically it doesn't matter. If you're under oath to support the Constitution of the United States and have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, in other words, insurrection or rebellion against the Constitution, not the government, not the president, the Constitution, in other words, you're repelling invaders. The Constitution says that's what we're supposed to do. And you say, no, we're going to classify them as immigrants and we're going to give them aid and comfort. That right there is rebellion against the Constitution. Clearly, all they're doing is they're trying to redefine something so that they can enable bad behavior and attack the United States. Right? So that's what it says. Shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, against the Constitution, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof, the enemies of the Constitution, these people that are clearly violating our laws, not trying to become citizens, not trying to assimilate, they're invaders, they're trespassing, then they cannot. Those people supporting them, those politicians, this long list of anybody, mayors, sanctuary counties, sanctuary states, Bob Ferguson. What he is doing is he is literally engaged in an insurrection and rebellion against the Constitution. And he's also getting a bunch of aid and comfort from Republicans in the State House. There's not one Republican in the Washington State Legislature that's calling these people, all invaders, to be repelled and pointing to Bob and all the Democrats, the communists running the state of Washington. They're not actually getting in their grill, poking them in the eye and saying, look, you can't be in office. You're openly running an insurrection against the Constitution and you've got to go. Therefore, they should be turning around and going to the Department of Justice and saying, you got to give us relief. You have to remove these people. This, folks, is your problem. The reason these people are getting away with murder And treason is because we are not demanding this Supreme Court, or not the Supreme Court, the supreme law of the land must be enforced. It must be complied to. This is the 14th Amendment, folks. Remember, we started this show off with telling you about how the evil has, you know, created these labels. And there's camps in both the progressive as well as the conservative. Oh, the 14th Amendment, that's bad. I know all about that. That's bad. That just shows you how imbecilic they are. They've never read the debates like I have. We have the debates for you, all 263 pages, uploaded onto reclaimingtherepublic.org. Pull them in. Look at how they actually went through this line by line and explained exactly what this Section 3 meant. What it means is, if you're in office and you actually violate the Constitution, or you fail to hold another member that has violated the Constitution accountable for their violations, then both of you got to go. That's right. If you're not holding them accountable, you're giving them aid and comfort to stay in office. This is why the entire state legislature of the state of Washington needs to be removed. The entire court system in the state of Washington needs to be removed. So what has to happen is the Department of Justice needs to kind of come in and put these governments, these state governments, into check and go through, as well as the cities and so forth, and basically not declare martial law. This is not martial law. It's a conservatorship. It is a conservatorship because now you don't have people to drive the ship, so now you need some people to come in and do the basics to help everybody start identifying their replacements and ensuring that these replacements will know you violate your oath, you're going to go. Because once you open this is like Pandora's box. Section 3 has been obviated. They have been doing everything they can never to enforce this. Because the day we start enforcing this, all the evil and corruption in our government gets removed. I want you to understand this. It was Satan's interest to basically ensure that everybody looked at the Constitution or the 14th Amendment as a real problem. Because that way you wouldn't find out about Section 3. I can't tell you how many years I have heard people complaining about the oath of office. The John Birch Society says, oh, it's all about Article 6. It's about the oath. But they don't mention Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, nor do they even mention the First Amendment petition in holding them accountable. You can hold them accountable, but they don't want you to know about the first. Why? Why is it that they don't want you to actually get engaged? Because if we actually start getting rid of the corruption in our government by actually following the law, then the goose that lays their golden eggs going to die. Folks, I can't say this enough. It is all about compliance of the Constitution. I cannot emphasize this enough, that the day you actually understand Section 3 and what it does and demand every public servant be held accountable and removed for their violations, the day we put America quickly on the track of healing itself. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as Republic review. Please read my argument for Republic review, as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.